Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how geography affects sexual freedom since the Supreme Court overturned the case Roe v. Wade. What are the legal ramifications of the huge geographical swaths of women who have no access to abortion? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In June of 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the national right to access to an abortion in the decision Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health. And since that decision, 14 states have fully banned abortion, five others have extremely severe restrictions, and seven others have passed restrictions that are currently in litigation. In short, the United States is divided nearly evenly between states where they have passed laws making abortion illegal and half where the procedure is legal. And on today's show, we will explore what this means for reproductive rights in this country, exploring the legal landscape with many of these proposed restrictions and what women have and can practically do to ensure the freedom of reproductive freedom, the freedom to control their bodies. Our panel today is Greer Donnelly. She's Associate Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh's Law School. She's the author of Medication Abortion Exceptionalism and Abortion, Pregnancy Loss, and Subjective Fetal Personhood, The New Abortion Battleground, with David Cohen and Rachel Rebishaw. This was cited by the Supreme Court's dissent in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization decision. Carol Jaffe is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She's the author of Doctors of Conscience, The Struggle to Provide Abortion Before and After Roe v. Wade, and Dispatches from Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. And Robin Marty, she's the executive director for the West Alabama Women's Center. Also, she's a freelance reporter. She's the author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America, and co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Right's Plans to Destroy Legal Abortion. Thank you all very much for joining us. Greer Donnelly, we'll start with you. Since the Dobbs decision, there have been numerous legal cases explaining exactly the nature of some of these states' bans and some of the different proposals. What have been some of the most significant legal cases, legal proceedings since Dobbs?
So first, thanks so much. I'm happy to be here. And, you know, you did a very nice description at the beginning showing the reality of the current moment where, you know, the rights or access people have to abortion at this point in time really depends on where you live. And that reality is part of the reason that we're seeing such chaos in kind of the legal context in this post-Dobbs world. So there's a lot of things that are going on, active litigation across multiple fronts, and I'll kind of try to touch on some of them, but there are many others. You probably have been reading a lot in the news about kind of the state court litigation that where you see a lot of attempts right now to try to include the right to abortion within a state constitution. So that's a lot of the states that have bans that are currently enjoined by the courts are involve issues related to that. You're seeing a lot of cases related to medical emergencies. So we've seen cases in Texas and many other places where you have plaintiffs that have, you know, really been harmed by abortion bans. People typically in these cases, the plaintiffs are often folks with wanted pregnancies who face fetal anomaly diagnoses later in pregnancy or a medical emergency. And the fact that the states have banned abortion and have very limited life exceptions has led to pretty significant harm. So we're seeing a lot of movement related to that. We're also seeing a lot of movement related to abortion pills. So probably one of the most famous and talked about cases in the last few months is one out of Texas, where you have anti-abortion plaintiffs that are suing the FDA trying to get the first drug in a medication abortion called mifepristone removed from the market. And so that case is currently right now we have the government just this week is trying to get cert to have the Supreme Court hear that case. So there are, you know, these are just like cherry picking small, like a few of the legal issues that are coming up. There are, you know, the reality is that Roe provided this floor, which, you know, no abortion rights activist would have said is good enough by any means, but it did provide, you know, some kind of consistency across states, at least a little bit. And now with that totally blown up, we're living in a world where there's a lot of chaos, a lot of uncertainty, and things are changing by the day in states. It's really hard to keep up. And, you know, that will continue to persist, I think, in the years to come.
And Carol Joffe, something that Greer Donnelly had referenced about medical care, certainly there's been numerous narratives about the way in which some of these state laws have made it complicated, if not just extremely difficult, for doctors to provide certain types of services. And it seems like doctors in some states, I know Texas, this has been a huge issue, have opted to just be extremely conservative in providing any sort of abortion care, even when there's medical issues. How significant is this across the country?
Well, it's very significant in the states that have banned abortion. And just echoing what Greer said, I think one of the main takeaways of what we've seen in the years since Dobbs is just chaos, uncertainty, doctors heartbroken, putting their patients in ambulances or in some cases on airplanes to safe states. And I, you know, I should make clear, and when Robin Marty from Alabama joins us, I'm sure she can tell you more. In Alabama, in Texas, we are talking about literally life imprisonment for doctors. So understandably, there's a lot of hesitation. It's really, it's horrible for patients, as Greer made clear. It's horrible for these healthcare providers who have pledged their, you know, their lives to take care of people and now are in this horrible situation of not knowing what's legal, what's not legal. Often there's disagreements within the hospital. The doctors may wish to proceed, but the hospital council will make the, you know, the final decision, and he or she is usually more conservative and doesn't want to rattle, you know, chains. And let me just say that for me, as a sociologist who has observed this field of abortion care for many, many years, one of the most interesting things to come out of this, beyond the horrific pain imposed on many patients, is that we as a society are forced to confront that pregnancy can be very dangerous. And that usually has been hidden. I mean, before Dobbs, many pregnancy-capable people across the country, if they had an ectopic pregnancy, if their water broke, which in medical terms is called PPROM, premature previability rupture of membranes. I mean, all these situations that are common in pregnancy, as a society as a whole, we didn't need to confront it, because what happened is, typically, even in states that were very restrictive on abortion, patients typically, if their lives were threatened by an ectopic pregnancy, of course, even in very conservative states, even with doctors who did not think of themselves as abortion providers, these people would be quietly taken care of. And Dobbs has changed that. Now we are forced to confront how many pregnancies go tragically very wrong, whether they're wanted or not. They can put women's lives and well-being and fertility capacity at risk. One of the women who sued Texas in one of the cases that Greer alluded to, by the time she got the termination, the abortion that she needed, she lost one of her fallopian tubes. Her future fertility is at risk. So here's this person who desperately, desperately wants a baby, who because of the barbaric rules of Texas may or may not be able to successfully have another pregnancy.
Now, Greer, one of the things that Carol Joffe highlights here is the kind of medical risks that women face, you know, during pregnancies. And I think of the discourse during the oral arguments and the discussions around the Dobbs decision was just kind of treating pregnancy more like an inconvenience. And, you know, women can go ahead, give birth. Adoption is really easy. You can just drop the baby off at a firehouse, you know, even seem to be some of the discussions. But now there's this reality that, you know, you all have known, but the country hadn't really talked about, the medical risk that pregnancies pose. Is this making its way at all into the legal proceedings, or is it really more of a political and social?
I mean, I think you're exactly right. I mean, we've seen for so long in the abortion case law, so much of the work has been done saying we don't want to force parenthood on people, right? And this is why when you listen to the Dobbs oral argument, you heard Justice Barrett say, really emphasizing the possibility of adoption, saying we're at a place now, right, where people are not going to be forced to be parents anymore, really completely and totally overlooking the burdens of pregnancy and what they impose. So I loved Carol's point talking about this, you know, this post-Dobbs moment, just highlighting that. Is it coming up in the case law? Certainly in all of the cases related to medical emergency. And so not only do you have the case we've been spending a lot of time talking about is in Texas, but there's also cases related to EMTALA. That's a federal statute that requires hospitals to provide emergency care. And, you know, federal law trumps state law. So the idea here is that that federal statute requiring emergency care should govern in many medical emergencies. And you've seen cases where the Biden administration is trying to really urge that interpretation and use the EMTALA to go after hospitals and to try to partially invalidate state bans. So certainly the medical emergencies and the medical risk associated with pregnancy is coming out in the case law. But I think, you know, its force coming out just in the media articles might be even more important, just to changing kind of our cultural attitudes about what should be expected of people and how hard pregnancy truly is.
No, absolutely. An assumption with that question that social reality, social discourse, even political discourse has an impact on legal proceedings. We'll come back and ask exactly how much the law, how much, you know, the judges care about these questions. But I want to bring Robin Marty into the conversation. Robin, you've more than anybody on this panel, very much on the front line of provision of reproductive care. Since Dobbs, how have women who are seeking abortion care, seeking reproductive care, how have they been managing to be able to seek that care? What are your impressions about how successful women have been being able to get reproductive health care?
My lawyer says I can't answer that question. No, I'm only slightly joking, but that's actually where we are right now in Alabama, is the fact that my clinic is one of the lead plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the state over the fact that we have been threatened with prosecution for telling people where they can go to access legal abortion. So we're not even talking about, okay, providing people with information on how they can manage their own care outside of legal channels. We're not talking about trying to help people get to those doctors of consciences, Carol was calling them earlier, which we don't have here, because we can't have here, because now if it gets found out that you even so much as helped somebody get an abortion, that could be 99 years in jail. So the actual impact of what these laws are doing to us is terrifying. When a patient contacts us and says that they believe they're pregnant and they want an abortion, all we are able to do is then tell them that abortion is illegal in Alabama. And of course, that is the first thing that we have to say. And then we tell them that if they want to confirm their pregnancy, they are welcome to come in to us, and we will provide them with as much information as we can in order for them to decide what their choice is going to be moving forward. However, we cannot let them know where there are near clinics. We cannot let them know which is the state that would be closest to them. We cannot tell them, based on how far along they are, whether they are able to have a medication abortion or a procedural abortion, or how much time they have in order to be able to even access that abortion before they are not going to be under a gestational limit by any sort of nearby state, which for us, that's Florida for 14 weeks. And sometimes people can slip into Georgia under 6 weeks, but that's all we have here. And I want to make it very clear that even before this decision came down, the most recent statistics on maternal health out here is that Alabama is now number one when it comes to the maternal mortality rate. And at this point, for Black women especially, one in every 100 Black women who give birth will die. One in 100. And as someone who sees predominantly Black, predominantly low income, and usually with no preventative health care patients in her clinic, I cannot help but every day as people come in wonder, are you the one who is going to die because they will not let you have an abortion?
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the post-Dobbs climate for access to abortion and reproductive rights, reproductive health. Our guests today are Greer Donnelly of the University of Pittsburgh's Law School, Carol Jaffe of the University of California at San Francisco, and Robin Marty, the Executive Director at the West Alabama Women's Center. So you raise two specific issues. I want to make sure to get the legal and then the social question. So I'll turn back to Greer. One of those is a number of states are attempting to pass laws that would make it illegal for a woman to cross state lines to be able to have access to an abortion. I guess, first of all, you know, as a layperson in the law, is that constitutional to ban interstate travel? And if it is, what are some of the legal provisions that would even allow for the enforcement of such a law?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to note is that there's tremendous uncertainty related to that very question, right? We live in a country where until very recently, and probably if this hadn't been an issue concerning abortion, we would have assumed as settled law that people can travel across state lines and take advantage of the laws of another state, right? I mean, just think of regular things that have been happening for decades in this country related to gambling, related to weed and other types of, you know, recreational drugs, right? So that has kind of been the assumed baseline. But, you know, there's practically very little case law involving any of these legal questions. A lot of the doctrines upon which the right to travel have been based are kind of are a little bit vulnerable right now. You know, like one of the doctrines for right to travel is in the substantive due process clause. That was the doctrine that created the right to abortion that was just overturned, right? And potentially calls into question the Dobbs called into question the entire doctrine itself. So there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Do I think it's unconstitutional? Absolutely, I do. And there are very good legal arguments to say that a law like that is unconstitutional. But it is not people would be, you know, lawyers are being very risk averse in this moment for good reason. They're worried and trying to protect the providers that they're offering legal counsel to and telling them about risks, right? I'll note, and I think it's just so important that you know, what Robin said and the fact that the anti-abortion movement is using just this uncertainty to create threats, right? And those threats are, you know, being deemed as credible because they do have real risks. And it's chilling care and it's creating an enormous culture of fear throughout all of these banned states that I think is one of the biggest harms that we're seeing, right? Is that you have a lot of people in this country, if you look at news articles and stuff that interview the folks in the South and in the Midwest, that actually think it's illegal to leave the state to get an abortion. There is no state in the country right now where it is illegal to leave the state to get an abortion. The only one tiny maybe exception to that would be is if you're a minor in Idaho and you don't have parental consent, there is a law that makes it illegal for someone to help you leave the state to get abortion. But that's the one exception, right? There are these few small cities in Texas that have passed laws that make it illegal for you to use their highways to leave the state to get an abortion. But, you know, practically speaking, those things are unlikely to be enforced. But still, there's a huge culture of fear impacting whether what patients think that they're allowed to do. And you see patients that are saying, I didn't want to tell anyone. I left in the dark of night, leaving the state to get an abortion. And like that is itself, you know, part of the point, right? People say cruelty is the point, right? That's part of it right now. So I think, you know, we might see more and more movement to try to stop people from leaving, try to criminalize more travel. And those, if that happens, those, you know, laws will be challenged and we'll see more precedent related to the right to travel. But in this moment, there's uncertainty and uncertainty creates legal risk.
If I can just follow up with what Greer just said, one thing we talk all the time about the fear that patients are feeling, is this a legal thing that I'm doing, so on and so forth. We do not talk enough, in my opinion, about how it has destroyed the doctor-patient relationship, because doctors can no longer trust their patients. And that is the thing that has been so harrowing here, is that when we have a call and somebody says, if I can't get access to an abortion, I'm going to wrap my car around a pole. Like, our instinct is, okay, we need to do whatever we can to help you. But we also don't know, is that a real patient or is that someone who's trying to entrap us and make sure that there is a recording that they can send over to the attorney general? So we have to assume that every person that we talk to in the clinic, outside the clinic, contacting us, emailing us, every single one of them is actually somebody that is lying to us and that we cannot trust. And that is so bad for building any form of long-term healthcare relationship.
And Carol Jaffe, I presume that in your research and your relationship with doctors that you've had some similar experiences.
Yes. And I mean, I actually quite familiar with Robin's clinic. The doctor there is extraordinary. She has spent literally 10 years, 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, that's seven, another 3 years of fellowship, you know, preparing to become one of the most skillful and compassionate abortion providers in the country. And so this doctor who moved to Alabama with a mission to serve the people in that community now can't do what she's been trained to do. And as Robin has said, you know, can't entirely trust, the anti-abortion movement, which no longer calls itself pro-life, that's a small favor to be grateful about. The anti-abortion movement has been very skillful in having plants, I mean, and taking videos of providers who didn't know they were being videotaped. So yes, in addition to worrying about a 99-year imprisonment, you also have to worry about, are you being filmed? I mean, it's really quite tragic. And doctors don't know who they can trust. And I just want to reemphasize just how difficult this has been. I mean, obviously the major difficult for the patients, no question. Mm-hmm. My colleagues and I at UCSF have been doing a project called Care Post Roe. We've been asking doctors other clinicians all over the country to give us to submit testimonies confidentially over a website of how care has changed. What can they do? What can they not do that they used to do? And we've been getting testimonies both from red states and from blue states, from the red state people who are heartbroken that they can't do what is, I mean, can you imagine being a trained OBGYN and not being able to give someone an ectopic pregnancy until you're convinced she's three quarters dead? I mean, that's right. Insane. The blue state people who've been giving us testimonies, you know, are just beyond shocked at the cases that are coming to them. These people arriving very ill. I remember I interviewed a doctor in North Carolina who described, you know, a woman with her mother driving to North Carolina. This is when North Carolina did not pass its more restrictive bill. The woman literally started to deliver a fetus as she was in the car driving the 4 hours from her house to. Right. So, I mean, that's the insanity. People are flying. People from Texas are flying to Colorado just to make sure that their miscarriage is complete, because they were scared to tell their gynecologist at home in Texas. They had a miscarriage. They were afraid they'd be accused of having had an abortion. I mean, this is the insanity that's now going on all over the country.
Greer, I know we're going to lose you in just a moment, but I want to see if I can at least get a quick response. One last, you know, legal question, and that is the status of mifepristone, because with medical abortion or at-home abortion being available, wouldn't remove all these issues, but at least would remove some of these issues. What is the current status, the FDA approval for mifepristone, and what can we expect?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to know at the outset is that the Supreme Court currently has a stay imposed that will maintain the status quo throughout the course of the litigation. So the most important thing to note is that despite a bunch of news stories, you know, the Fifth Circuit just came out with an opinion. Soon the Supreme Court's going to decide whether or not to take the case. At least for right now, the status quo is maintained. So basically what happened, as a reminder, is plaintiffs sued the FDA saying that the first drug in a medication abortion should not have been approved, was improperly approved, is unsafe, a bunch of claims that would have been laughed out of court if it hadn't been filed at Amarillo, Texas, where one particular anti-abortion judge was guaranteed to get the case. That judge, Judge Kaczmarek, did exactly what the anti-abortion people thought he did. He issued a pretty wackadoodle opinion, that's the official legal term, where he basically said, you know, we're going to suspend the approval of the drug. And if that had gone into effect, which it never did, the drug mifepristone would have become unapproved in this country. This went up to the Fifth Circuit, or the Supreme Court. There was a stay. It went back down to the Fifth Circuit. And just recently, the Fifth Circuit said, no, we're not going to go so far as Judge Kaczmarek. We're going to allow the drug to remain approved, but we are going to suspend kind of later actions that the FDA took in 2016 and in 2019 to kind of make the drug a little bit less difficult to obtain. So really important to note at the outset that mifepristone, despite having the safety profile of very common medications like Tylenol, Viagra, penicillin, is regulated extremely harshly by the FDA. So the FDA still regulates it much more harshly than most other drugs. But in 2016, and again, very recently, the FDA made it a little bit easier to access it. Not easy, not normal, but a little bit easier. The Fifth Circuit would go back to that. We're waiting to see if the Supreme Court is going to take that case. If it does, we will see what the Supreme Court says. So, you know, a few things I want to note about this case for everybody, right? The first one is that there are two drugs involved in medication abortion. The second drug, misoprostol, is not at issue. So that drug will remain on the market no matter what, and it can be used on its own to terminate a pregnancy. The second thing is that this case only concerns, you know, people who are getting this drug through the formal healthcare system legally. Right? Many, many people at this point are accessing medication abortion through informal networks or through organizations like Aid Access, which are shipping pills directly into red states. And so for those organizations, they will almost certainly continue to offer their services because they're operating kind of extra legally already. So all of those things are just kind of, you know, disclaimers about the fact that this case is very important. And it would be a really radical departure from regular food and drug law, regular administrative law, regular kind of standing principles, all this stuff, if the Supreme Court were to agree with the plaintiffs. But even if that were to happen, there are some ways for people to continue to access medication abortion, even with a bad outcome.
Note that Greer Donnelly needs to leave us at this point. So thank you very much for joining us.
When we come back, access to mifepristone, the medicine used to terminate pregnancy, has been severely restricted. What has been the effect of these restrictions? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How has the Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade altered medical care and the medical profession? How are women in the most restricted geographies coping? And how are people in states where abortion is legal helping them? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Greer Donnelly. She's Associate Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh's Law School. She's the author of Medication Abortion Exceptionalism and Abortion, Pregnancy Loss, and Subjective Fetal Personhood, The New Abortion Battleground. With David Cohen and Rachel Rebishaw, this was cited by the Supreme Court's dissent in the Dobbs versus Jackson, a Women's Health Organization decision. Carol Jaffe is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She's the author of Doctors of Conscience, The Struggle to Provide Abortion Before and After Roe v. Wade, and Dispatches from Abortion Wars, The Costs of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. And Robin Marty, she's the executive director for the West Alabama Women's Center. Also, she's a freelance reporter. She's the author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America and co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Right's Plans to Destroy Legal Abortion. Robin Marty, you may not be able to answer this question if you can't would actually, you know, answer the question itself. And that is, we talked about mifepristone and the provision of pharmaceutical abortion, or, you know, the ability to use medication rather than going to a clinic. First of all, are you able to make that recommendation, or is that illegal in a state that has banned abortion?
I can answer the question and say I do not, as a clinician, recommend that any person in Alabama reach out to places like aidaccess.org in order to obtain medication abortion, which could be sent directly to them at their home. Because if I said something like that, especially if I said that in the clinic or to a patient directly, then that would be, according to the Attorney General, possibly a criminal conspiracy. What I can say is that there are many different places where people are finding ways to access medication. I have no doubt that there are people in Alabama who are doing the same, which is why the Attorney General is so frustrated right now. But I also know that the people who are probably accessing this medication, they are the lucky ones. They are the ones with the resources. They are the ones who understand how to use the internet. They are the ones who are able to sift through all of the websites. They are the ones who can trust that when something is delivered at home, that they're not going to have a partner who is going to open it and do something to them. And also that this is a system that is not going to be able to be sustainable in any way, shape, or form. The worst thing, in my opinion, about the medication abortion case is the way that it took every blue state that was doing something to try and help support red states that had lost all of their abortion access, and it made them circle the wagons on themselves. They started stockpiling, they started their shield laws, they started doing everything to protect themselves, which is amazing, but they left us out dry. My patients are never going to be able to get to a blue state clinic in order to get help. When they are able to access medication online, they are not going to be able to get into a clinic if they need any sort of follow-up. They are not going to feel comfortable, even if they are provided with information about people that they can call, to actually call up and ask questions, because they know that that is how they could get in trouble. All they are going to be able to do is go into an emergency room if something goes wrong, because they have no one to talk to and no one to tell them that this is actually normal or you can do this instead. One of my biggest disappointments when it comes to this post-Dobbs era is how we abandoned the South. We closed all of the clinics down here. There were people who could have left networks. I'm looking at you, Planned Parenthood, because I always do. They could have kept places open to ensure that there were safe places that a person can go to in order to get miscarriage management, in order to make sure that that abortion was complete without worry about being turned in at a hospital. And this is in the best interest of blue states as well as red states. And I can't make this more clear. We know that hospitals are tracking this. We know that doctors are paying attention. If they ask somebody, even if they went to a legal abortion clinic where they went, we know that they are keeping records. And so this is going to come back and be used against blue state clinics, either to try to close them or to be used as, I almost swore, don't swear on the show, as false information that can then be compiled later by groups like Charlotte Lozier Institute in order to try and pass a total national abortion ban. And we know this because this is how they started the medication abortion ban, by using the idea that patients coming into emergency rooms in red states would, and in other states, would, by virtue of being in there, somehow overwhelm emergency rooms. And so that was a reason why they could say medication abortion was unsafe and should not be happening anywhere. So if you do not keep supporting the South, if you do not continue to make sure that clinics like mine are open as safe areas for people to go to both before and after care, then that is how we're going to lose everything across the whole nation.
And Carol Jaffe, part of what Robin just highlighted here is just the importance of just providing care that's more than just physical care, being able to provide information, mental health concerns. In particular, I would imagine the most vulnerable are, you know, women who are pregnant for the first time. They need someone to help, you know, guide them through this. How much then are you seeing doctors' hands tied to be able to provide just basic fundamental prenatal care, which would include reproductive health and reproductive freedom? But there's a whole range across the board where we're seeing a lack of care, a perception of lack of ability to care.
I think providing prenatal care, if a patient is pregnant and wants to continue the pregnancy, I don't see that as a problem. I do want to go back to something Robin said. I would pose it a little different than she did, although ultimately agreeing with her on a core point. Five states now that have shield laws, New York, Vermont, I'm blocking on some of the other ones. These states have shield laws. Shield laws meaning that the states have passed legislation saying that providers there who provide care to people from banned states cannot be extradited. The state will not cooperate in a prosecution. Doctors in these states have started sending pills all over the country, including to banned states, and I assume Alabama. So some people in these banned states, the system is working. You know, they are getting the pills, they are told about a medication and abortion hotline that they can call if they have questions. I mean, there is a system in place. We don't know how many people are getting what we call, quote, self-managed abortions. However, Robin's crucial point, and which I agree with wholeheartedly, is this only works if you have a computer. This only works if you have the sophistication. And as Robin pointed out, the ability to literally live in a place where pills can be mailed to you and someone else, perhaps an abusive partner, won't find out. So there's, I would say, with respect to people getting the pills, you know, the cup is maybe a quarter, a third full, but it's not full like it should be.
And one more question that I have for you, Carol, because I know you're going to need to drop off as well. I know that for medication abortion, frequently we kind of changed this as a result of the pandemic was telehealth. And in some cases, doctors, not even based in the United States, but being able to provide prescriptions for these. What is the status of telehealth? Is this still as common as it seemed to be, you know, during the pandemic, and with a, you know, clear noted challenge with all of this? Not everybody has access to telehealth. Not everybody has access, even knows that this is even an option. But is it still fairly common practice?
Speaking broadly, I mean, beyond abortion, I mean, pandemic put telehealth on the map and it's not going away. I mean, I in California am offered telehealth visits with my primary care provider, and that's happening all over. I mean, abortion being abortion, as telehealth became more and more popular, anti-abortion states passed special legislation saying, yeah, you can have telehealth for other stuff, but not for abortion. So there's about 17 states that actually banned telehealth for abortion. But going back to what we said just a few minutes ago, many, many pregnant women and pregnancy capable people are using what we can call telehealth to get access to pills. But again, it's if you have a computer and if you live in a situation where you can safely get such pills sent to you. As you mentioned, I have to drop off. So I would like to just say one more thing, if I can, and then leave you in Robin's very capable hands.
Please do.
And what I would like to say is this has inevitably been a very sobering conversation. The situation is not good for certainly the most vulnerable people in our society. However, I don't want to leave this conversation without talking about the backlash. In the 2022 midterms, there were five, maybe six abortion-related measures, some of them in very conservative states, Montana, Kentucky, as well as more liberal ones. We've seen a referendum put to Ohio voters that ultimately will have a connection to abortion. There was a huge victory in Kansas, a Supreme Court justice who made very clear her abortion positive sentiments was elected in a landslide in Wisconsin, a state that usually has, you know, very, very, very close elections. So all of which shows us that the American people are disgusted with this. And electorally, our only hope, I believe, to push back against the disaster of Dobbs is continuing with these. That's not the only path forward, but everybody hearing this call, if you care about abortion rights, you have to vote. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Carol. Robin Marty, I do want to simply note that though what Carol just said, that when voters are asked explicitly about access to reproductive rights, they've been pretty clear that they want access to reproductive rights, but there have been quite a bit of legal political maneuvers. Specifically, Wisconsin sees the election of a Supreme Court justice, Janet Porter Sedgwick, I think I pronounced her name correctly, and ultimately anti-abortion groups are trying to impeach her to try to make sure that she can't actually rule on, you know, on decisions. So even politically, even by stating, you know, I think it's fair to say that the majority of Americans want access to abortion rights. It's very clear.
Please. I think that not only do a majority of Americans want access to abortion rights, the majority of Americans within states where it is banned, such as Alabama, such as Mississippi, such as Florida, also want abortion rights. What is really lost in the conversation, though, is that unfortunately, we can't vote. Like, I don't know a better way to say it. Our political system has beaten us and has been so misused to the point where you saw recently that Alabama is supposed to get a second majority minority district in order to potentially have two Black representatives out of the whole state, which is far more representative of the amount of Black people in the state itself. And when the Supreme Court said you didn't fix your map, Alabama said, okay, well, here's our map right back again because we don't care. And now the Supreme Court is going to hear it again, which that should be obvious contempt of court, in my opinion. But like, what is the federal power going to do? We don't know. And honestly, there's a very strong possibility that either the Supreme Court will say, okay, well, we toss our hands in the air because this time you made better arguments, because literally when they brought it to Alabama the first time, they said your arguments weren't quite what we wanted to hear, and then kind of gave an explanation of how you could say it in a way that might get it to pass the next time. But also, either way, it's not going to get done in time for people to be able to vote in the upcoming election. So we have a corrupt process. We have gerrymandering down here. Alabama and Mississippi will never be able to have a ballot initiative that will allow us to vote on abortion. Mississippi banned all ballot amendments that from public vote after the, I think it was that they voted to pass marijuana As a state. And so they just decided, okay, ballot initiatives no longer mean anything. They have said that they're willing to bring back ballot initiatives, but only if it can never be used for abortion, which of course, because in 2011, Mississippi did vote on personhood and whether abortion should be completely illegal and if embryo should be protected from the moment of conception. And 60-40, they said, we don't want this. Alabama is the only state in the nation that has had a successful personhood vote. And now there is no way that we can run another amendment because in order to get an amendment out, it first has to be approved by the legislature. And our legislature is never going to approve something that would allow us to vote on abortion again. They're very happy with how things are right now. So there's only so much that can be done when we say, okay, let's go out and vote. Let's make sure that these ballot initiatives happen, because we still have to recognize that this is the South, and the South is going to be left behind. And we need to come up with a process that is going to bring the South in with everything else. And this is especially important because I'm hopeful. I am hopeful that there's going to be a really good presidential election and that we're going to have a sweep. And maybe we will actually have a federal situation where we can pass something on the federal level. But I don't know if I believe that Alabama would still follow it. They've opted out of every bit of federal legislation. And every time you would say, okay, so should Alabama be punished for using all of their COVID money for a prison? Nobody does anything. Should Alabama be punished for not letting their veteran centers do abortion when that was supposed to be a federal rule? Nobody does anything. They opted out of the Affordable Care Act. They still haven't expanded Medicaid. Alabama doesn't follow federal rules. How can we guarantee that Alabama will have to follow them if abortion is suddenly legal across the country?
You're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the post-Dobbs climate for access to abortion and reproductive rights, reproductive health. Earlier, we had Greer Donnelly from the University of Pittsburgh's Law School, Carol Jaffe from the University of California, San Francisco. And this last segment, we've got Robin Marty. She's the executive director of the West Alabama Women's Center. Now, previously, you had made a reference to maternal death rates. This is something that's starting to get more national attention, the fact that the U.S. has an unconscionable number of maternal deaths, in particular, considering the level of development, the level of, you know, medical expertise that we have. And of course, people who've studied this know this, but I'm not sure, you know, how well this is known nationally, that, you know, where you are in the country, you know, in the South and places like Alabama, Mississippi, et cetera, and the racialized element of maternal deaths, the fact that women of color and certainly poor women are much, much more likely, to die while in childbirth. And so how closely tied are what you just described about Alabama's attitudes about reproductive health, about, you know, federal mandates or, you know, federal programs, and the fact that you're in a state that just doesn't follow those? What is that connection?
It's absolutely horrible out here. I recently started doing a fellowship on maternal mortality and health equity. And I mean, obviously, my background is sexual and reproductive health. It was abortion access. Maternal health care is something that is still very new to me. And it's been horrendously eye-opening, because one of the things that we can see so clearly is Alabama's priorities. And Alabama's priorities are to make people get pregnant and then to make people have babies. And then whatever happens after that, they don't really care. And when I say they don't really care, I mean they don't really care as in what the health consequences are to the person who is pregnant, what the economic consequences are to the person who is pregnant, what the logistical support is for the person who is pregnant. Since Dobbs was decided, we have had no actual legislation that has done anything that would improve maternal mortality. The only thing that was introduced that could have even possibly done something was this idea of giving extra tax breaks to crisis pregnancy centers if they provided maternal health care, which most of them don't. We as a clinic do. We do free prenatal care for any person who does not have insurance, and we help them get onto insurance if they are eligible for Medicaid. But most of the crisis pregnancy centers don't. We actually would not have been eligible for those tax breaks because we are associated with abortion. So, and I should probably, this is radio, so I used air quotes just so people know. So they don't care about that side of the healthcare. However, what they did work on passing and did pass is one, these idea of baby boxes, which are infant boxes that could be placed at fire stations, things like that, and allowing a person to be able to drop off a newborn no longer within 72 hours of birth, but it could be up to 3 months after birth. And then the second was to change the laws and provide more compensation for people who were going to foster parent or who were going to adopt. And in a lot of ways, changing the laws actually is taking away some of the safeguards and making sure that the people who are adopting are safe people. So that's a little disturbing. But what that says to us when they don't expand Medicaid, when they don't provide any money for contraception, when they don't do anything to do any expansion of prenatal care, it says that they want people to still get pregnant. They want them to give birth. But if they die in childbirth, that's just fine because the whole goal is to get babies that they can then give to other people who are more worthy parents.
And one of the main themes that you've been talking about today, I want to explore a little bit further is, you know, I started the show talking about that we are in a pretty evenly divided country where about half the country has access to reproductive freedom, has access to abortions, but half the country doesn't. And you've highlighted why that's a problem if the blue states are basically selling out the red states and saying, we're just going to try to make sure that we have access and the impact this may have on a national abortion ban. What would be at the top of your list? I'm in a blue state at this point that you would want from blue states. I mean, obviously legislation that would legalize abortion, but are there other things in the interim as we hopefully move towards a national legalization of abortion across all states, once again, a return to Roe and maybe even stronger than Roe? What can blue states do that can help to strengthen access to reproductive health, access to reproductive freedom in the red states?
We really need blue states to do something either by encouraging lawmakers or encouraging philanthropy would be really wonderful. The reality is that big donors are in New York and California. They're the ones who are writing grants. They're the ones who are funding abortion centers that are opening in blue states. They are the ones who get to decide what this landscape looks like, and they don't care about us. And they either are doing it because it just doesn't occur to them, or they think it's a better use of resources to keep things where they are. There's also this idea that you shouldn't be supporting the South as if it should be boycotted because of our bad opinions, despite the fact that most of us don't have that opinion. And a lot of people aren't even allowed to vote in order to show that they don't have that opinion. So we're punishing the people who have the least amount of resources. One of the things that was really frustrating to me after the Attorney General last week, I think it was, I'm sorry, time is really meaningless to me. But when he responded to our lawsuit and said that, he totally believes that it's a conspiracy and he has absolutely no problem with prosecuting somebody who might break the conspiracy, Gavin Newsom responded on Twitter and said that in California, they would protect any person who got an abortion and would make sure that rules like that would never apply. There would never be a criminal conspiracy, etc. And that's lovely and all, but he can't do anything from over there. Like, if you want to actually support the people who are doing this work, like, California stockpiled so much medication. California is making sure that Medicaid covers abortion. California is doing all sorts of wonderful things, but California can find a way to provide some of those resources to Mississippi, to Alabama, because we are going to be the people that, if they get enough resources, they might actually be able to make it out to California, but they can't do that contacting California. They're not going to know that. They're not going to be able to do all of that. And also, again, we go back to the idea of when people come home, they need a place where they can have aftercare. So we see large states that have the capacity that they could provide grants out either through their own reproductive health organizations and send it out, or they can talk to their really big funders and say, you know, look at the stuff that is happening. We don't have the philanthropy. We don't have the foundations. We don't even have state support, because when it comes to any healthcare funding, all of it is block granted from the federal government straight to the Department of Health, who gets to decide who is going to participate. And obviously, they're not going to let us participate. In Alabama, There is no Title X funding that goes anywhere except for the county health department. So a county health department is the only place that a person who has no insurance or is low income can access a free IUD, can access a NuvaRing, can access these contraceptive options. You can't have it at Planned Parenthood. You can't have it at our clinic. We don't get that money. And that's money from the federal government that's supposed to go to us and honestly doesn't get to us. The same thing with Title V, which is maternal health care funding. Title V is federal funding that goes to each state that supports maternal and child health care. And in Alabama, we get about $10 million a year in this Title V funding. And of that, in the last year that I could find a report, $200,000 of that went to maternal health care. And the rest of it all went to newborn screenings and all of these things to support the baby after it was born. Because again, they just want that baby born healthy and they don't care who that baby belongs to.
The West Alabama Women's Center can receive donations from private individuals, right?
Yes, we are a nonprofit clinic. We are free and sliding scale, and we provide free contraception, free prenatal care, free anything that a person needs that is sexual health care related. You can find us at alreprohealth.com, and there's a big donate button on there. Everything is tax deductible.
And by the way, we will post that link to the show page. I think I share with all the panelists a real commitment, a passion, a need to ensure that we provide reproductive care, reproductive freedom, abortion access all over the country, and not just in the blue states. Our guests today have been Greer Donnelly, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. She's the author of Medication Abortion Exceptionalism and Abortion, Pregnancy Loss, and Subjective Person Fetalhood, The New Abortion Battleground. She wrote that with David Cohen and Rachel Robichaud and was cited in the dissent, Supreme Court's dissent in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. Carol Jaffe is professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She's the author of Doctors of Conscience, The Struggle to Provide Abortion Before and After Roe v. Wade, and Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. And Robin Marty, she's the executive director for the West Alabama Women's Center. Also, she's a freelance reporter. She's the author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America and co-author of The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Right's Plans to Destroy Legal Abortion. Robin, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Of course, anytime.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.